The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, the Champions League. Just what happened at White Hart Lane? Spurs led in seven as Serge Gnabry scores four in the second half for Bayern. Can Poch turn this around? And are any of his players facing in the same direction? Elsewhere, Liverpool keep their steamroller running, just as do Manchester City. Pep is sorry Phil Foden isn't getting enough minutes. If only there was something he could do to help the situation. Chelsea leave it late in Lille, while Bruges are minutes away from winning in Madrid. Elsewhere, we'll round up the Championship. There's a new CEO at the Premier League, stolen from the Guardian. But is it Barry? We'll look ahead to this weekend's fixtures, answer your question, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning. Is this your departing pod before you go over to run the Premier League?
Well, I believe the person who is leaving the Guardian to go and run the Premier League isn't going till the spring, so there'll be a handover, so I may feature on some pods in the interim.
Oh, excellent news. Philippe Auclair, how are you? Would you like to run the Premier League?
I would love to.
Okay.
Who wouldn't?
What was the first thing you would do?
One wonders if the Guardian principles are going to be put in practice at the Premier League, so you'll just pay what you want.
Oh, for that's a great idea, games. Isn't it? Yeah. They'll play the game, but at the end of the match, it'll say, we love you.
we have a small favour to ask.
football writer Johnny Nicholson, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Very pertinent. You've written a book called Can We Have Our Football Back? We'll get into it mainly in part three, but it is largely about the Premier League, isn't it?
That's right, absolutely. I was going to say, if you were going to ask me what I would do if I took over the Premier League, I'd break it with a massive hammer.
We'll find out more in part three. Let's begin then.
Yeah, unless some Guardian security goons come in and bounce him out of the building in the meantime.
Tottenham Hotspur 2, Bayern Munich 7. Two positives for Tottenham in the... We've established on the pod in recent days, one, that the Champions League group stages don't matter, and two, that Spurs had their season-defining result on Saturday against Southampton. But if we ignore those two things for just a moment, 7-2 is such an extraordinary scoreline, the heaviest defeat of an English side at home in European history. Philippe, how bad were Spurs? How good were Bayern?
Spurs were very good for 34, 35 minutes, not so good for a while and absolutely awful thereafter. I think that's about the summing up of it. Couldn't quite understand what was going on because towards the end of the game, it seemed that they thought they were going to win this game and expose themselves to very swift and clinical, I believe is the word that is being used, counter-attacking and finishing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to excuse Spurs at all, but have you ever, Barry, seen a more clinical display of finishing? I mean, all Bayern's goals were superbly taken. There were parts of the second half where just every shot went in. It was weird.
Well, they were given acres of room to operate in. It was a very good performance. And Spurs didn't help themselves by making it very easy for them, but... Yeah, I have seen clinical performances like that, and I would imagine it's no fun being on the wrong end of one, but Spurs are in a bad place right now, as we know and have known for quite some time.
Has no one noticed before that Alderweireld and Vertonghen are quite slow? I mean, I've always presumed, you know, these are two of the greatest centre-backs in the Premier League, great partnership, great at international level. They seem to be quite slow, slower than I've ever seen them before, and playing a higher line than I'd ever seen them before, arguably with not a lot of help from their fullbacks,
and without the ability to pass the ball accurately as well. So it's just a complete, nightmare. I thought what was really interesting about that 2-7 was if Spurs continue in this vein but still somehow manage to qualify for the next round, it will completely invalidate the whole idea of a group round, that you can get handed your arse 7-2 and still qualify. Because, you know, you shouldn't, if you lose 7-2, that should be you out. You know, just not good enough, you know. But, you know, the chances are they could still progress, which would be really bizarre.
Just on Vertonghen and Alderweireld, they've been around quite a long time and they're not getting any younger. That might explain their pedestrianism.
explain this age thing to us, Barry.
But it is, I mean, when... Yeah.
Wish your gob of Grandpa Simpson.
but certainly, Avery, Philippe, when he sort of just walked past Aldevira, you know, just Gary Neville talks a
he
lot,
also walked
he?
Past Serge Aurier.
That is true.
We're supposed to be very quick.
Yeah, well, Ross has a question. Can you ask Philippe to explain Serge Aurier, please? I have no idea whether he's a marvel or completely shite.
I think that Serge Aurier is unexplainable, and that's the beauty of Serge Aurier in a way. I've met people who've said when he was in Ligue 1 that he was the best right back in the league. And there are moments where you think, actually, they might have a point because he's super quick. He's got great crossing ability, and he can be a really tough fullback to go past. And then there are other days, and there are quite frequent, when he's the very, is the antonym of that. And actually, antonym is not the correct word, but you've understood what I meant.
Antithesis.
Antithesis. Thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
And no, he's, I don't think he's the most tactically aware player, which is a polite way of saying something else. And he's a liability. And which is one of the reasons why many people, myself included, I guess most of the people in this room and listening to us, were gobsmacked when they sold Kieran Trippier to Atletico. You thought, Serge Aurier is going to be really the fullback or Walker Peters? They're better than Trippier. Don't think so.
But wasn't that part of, you know, Trippier wanted to go? I think a lot of other Tottenham players seemed to want to go at the same time.
Yeah.
It was Serge Aurier wanted to go. I think Serge Aurier is one of those people who's gifted with the physical capabilities to be very good at football, but has no football brain. I mean, we've seen the past. He can't take a throw-in. Like, he literally is incapable.
He was the one who fouled twice in a single game.
Yeah.
That's right, yes.
I mean, that's extraordinary for a professional footballer to be penalised for that twice in one game. And there are footballers like that, but he's one of a lot of Spurs players, and I suspect a Spurs manager, who don't want to be at Spurs, which is a problem for them.
Do you think Pochettino doesn't want to be there now?
Absolutely. I don't think he's wanted to be there since possibly before the start of the season. I've said before, I think in our first pod of the season, that he won't be there by the end of the season. I firmly stand over that. I don't think he'll be sacked. He might be if things keep going this badly, but I would imagine he will leave. And to be honest, it's probably time for a change.
We've got some stats here which are just insane, really. Since mid-April, it's only 5 wins in 19 games. And the one which is absolutely extraordinary, among teams to have played in the Premier League in 2019, only Brighton and Hove Albion have lost as many matches as Tottenham in all competitions. That is staggering. But it's something we remarked on, I remember, last year, when we were talking about their progress in the Champions League, that in a way, they qualified for the Champions League this year only because Arsenal completely lost it in the last 6 rounds of the Premier League, that they had a record number of defeats, and the only reason why they were there is that because they didn't draw games this time round. And so there was a feeling that, oh my goodness, it's already unravelling. And also, I'll add one last thing, is that the funny thing, funny for some, is that you were talking about Manchester United and Real Madrid, but the club, which I understand was the keenest on him, was Bayern Munich. When it seemed that Kovac was not going to work and was having problems with the dressing room, and Bayern were really, really interested in Pochettino.
So basically, getting to the Champions League final papered over the cracks, which is, I mean, that's quite a... It's quite a thick piece of paper, I guess.
Yeah, they only just got there, didn't they, with the way results went. But I was said to take my typically flippant attitude to this. If you look at the history of Spurs managers, when they start to lose their authority, they tend to wear shorter coats. Now, if you look, Pochettino's now sporting one of these mid-thigh length, little kind of overcoaty things.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it gets shorter, you get to the Phyllis Boas, little shorty jacket. Then further still, you get to the Sherwood Gilet. You see, and the smaller the coat.
The Christian Gross crop top that we all remember.
That's right. The Bill Nicholson boob tube.
The reports now are saying that Harry Kane might get frustrated. You can see that happening, Johnny, can you?
Yeah, I mean, Kane doesn't strike me as the most, ambitious of players. So I don't say that critically. I don't think he's one of these kind of guys that has a burning desire to go and play for whoever's incredibly fashionable or successful at the time. I rather think he's quite a conservative chap, probably likes just playing for Spurs. And I think that will take some shifting out of Spurs for that, depending on who comes in next, really, I think. But I have a strange attitude towards Kane. This is not his fault or anything to do with him, really. It's just all in my head. But I expect him to fail every season. I don't know why. I just expect him to be no good. And he's always really good. We all have players like that, don't we? You know, you just say and think, yeah, that was a flash in the pan that season. Yeah, that was as well. And the third one, that was a flash in the pan.
Are you going to maintain this every single
summer? I'm not giving in now.
You've committed to it.
History will prove me right eventually. When he's 39.
Gaz says, am I the only one not in full crisis mode at Spurs? The scoreline was awful. Obviously, things behind the scenes that need sorting. At 4-2 against the top team, we took off our entire midfield for three attackers to push for goals. More like a gamble that didn't pay off. Showed more quality than either Arsenal or Man United on Monday.
It depends on what your definition of crisis is, I suppose. There will be other fans who may start agitating. I think some of them already have. Pochettino must go. The fact that Spurs haven't actually won anything under Pochettino, I don't see that as a failure, because it's been quite the white knuckle ride with him in charge. It makes it difficult to, you know, so we didn't win anything under previous managers. He's come along. We haven't won anything under him. So everything's sort of as it was, except we're a bit better than we used to be. But is it a crisis? Because, you know, nothing's really changed.
The headline, Spurs in slight net positive, is not quite as catchy, is it?
But I think if they had been winning trophies on a semi-regular basis under him, and now they were losing all these games and getting humiliated at home by Bayern Munich, then, yeah, possibly you could go, that's a crisis. But I think, well, we didn't win anything before him. We haven't won anything with him, and next man along, well, we probably won't win anything with him either. So it's all a bit shoulder shrug looking at it from the outside.
Also in that group, Red Star Belgrade beat Olympiakos 3-1.
A result that doesn't quite tell the story of the game in which Olympiakos were actually excellent, but probably the best result that Spurs could hope for, because I don't think Red Star Belgrade are going to be candidates for qualification. So, and we might have this, just as John said, you know, we might have exactly this situation where a club loses 7-2 and qualifies for the round of 16.
Off to Anfield, Liverpool 4, RB Salzburg 3. What a great game this was. Liverpool were 3-0 up. Barry, what happened then?
I think complacency set in. I think Salzburg stopped being as overwhelmed as they possibly had been at, you know, being at the temple of European football. And they conceded 3 goals. Some of their defending was hideously bad. Liverpool's, you know, Virgil van Dijk is a fine player, but he didn't have a very good game last night. And Joel Matip wasn't playing, and he's been outstanding for Liverpool so far this season. And his absence showed, but you know, they got there in the end. They won.
Johnny?
I sense Barry has an existential crisis about football generally. Just like, well, it happened and then it wasn't happening anymore. I share this totally. You know, it's just like, what's the point? Why don't we all just die?
Before the sort of strange crisis, I've used crisis again, far too sensationalist. Before they just took their foot off the gas for a little bit.
Yeah.
That Andy Robertson goal, Philippe, was such a joy, wasn't it?
It was glorious. The Sadio Mane goal as well. My goodness. Wow. And I think they're, and also they've now become what you can call Liverpool goals. That you could watch it, you wouldn't have the numbers in the back, you couldn't see the faces, you would say, oh, that looks very much like a Liverpool goal to me. Absolutely glorious.
Is there a better attacking fullback in the world? Is that too much?
Than
Robertson?
At the moment, I think that the people who vote for the best have decided Marcelo was a better left back than, which is quite astonishing, really. But people say that Kieran Tierney could be even better. There you go. We shall see. But I don't know. It's not a position in which you have a great number of obvious candidates. You know, Jordi Alba would have been, you know, the choice of many people, but he's been up and down all through the season, like his team has. So why the heck not?
The great thing about Robertson in that game as well was that obviously he normally does his attacking down the left, but he was actually playing centre forward at times. And you actually, even the time he didn't score, there was two or three other times when he was just started to come in from the left, ended up on the soft centre of the penalty box. And I love to see that. It's just that puts me in mind of Dutch football in the early to mid-70s, where suddenly everybody would be in, the centre-forward would be a centre-half, and then like the centre-half would be scoring goals, and it was fantastic because you never knew where you were going to get it next.
I was just about to ask. I was just thinking, you know, has the, and maybe that counters the question that I'm about to ask, which is, you know, has the role of fullback changed more than any other role in football? I mean, you just can't imagine Julian Dix, you know, or Stuart Pearce just ending up at centre forward.
I would say that the goalkeeper's work has changed even more. And there were before fullbacks, rampaging fullbacks. I mean, Giacinto Facchetti was one of them, for not one of the most attacking teams internationally. And there have been a few, but as a rule, yes, the position has now become absolutely central. Well, so to speak, fullback becoming central to the way that the teams are playing, very energy driven. And the fact that few teams are playing with out-and-out wingers as well, or were. So therefore, there's more onus on the people who are on the flanks to go up and down the pitch all the time. So yes, it has changed tremendously.
It's a bit like the hacker, the New Zealand hacker. You know, they've been getting a bit of stick during this Rugby World Cup because everyone, you have to stand and face this slightly ludicrous pre-match ritual.
Very ludicrous, yeah.
And,
that's ludicrous, yeah.
Well, I would say very, but then everyone in New Zealand gets upset. So slightly ludicrous. But people have been showing, you know, hackers, a hacker from the 70s before they played the Barbarians. The Barbarians were just doing their own thing. And you saw this group of sort of mustachioed New Zealanders looking nothing like rugby players, not really knowing how to do the hacker, and getting a big cheer from the stands at, I think, Twickenham. And now you look at this thing and they form an arrowhead and it's very theatrical and there's tongues hanging out and it's very more choreographed than some of their on-field moves, I'd imagine. And that is, you know, fullback of today compared to fullback of the 70s.
The other fullback, Josh says, Trent Alexander-Arnold is increasingly becoming the target for opposing teams. Is he the most gifted weak link in history?
That's a great question.
If not, who? Has anyone spotted that? Has anyone?
Yeah, he's been targeted a few times. It's because he's still only, what, 20?
Yeah.
So he's developing into especially the defensive part of the game, and he can be sometimes a bit rash in his decision and or not quick enough in his reaction. And yes, so he's been targeted, but with inverted, you know, commas and brackets and all these sort of things. I think targeting Trent Alexander-Arnold is not something that many team in the Premier League will be able to do.
Sheffield United certainly targeted him on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Just put ball after ball in behind him.
That's how to play him. I know Red Bull Salzburg are no mugs, are they? In recent years, two seasons ago, they beat Real Sociedad, Dortmund and Lazio to get to the semis of the Europa League. In the same competition last season, they won all six of their group stage matches. So, you know, a win is a win, right, for Liverpool?
And it was a good demonstration of their attitude, you know, because being 3-0 up, conceding three, it's, you would think the other team would have the psychological advantage, and Liverpool just immediately went, okay, right, let's deal with this, up their game. I think my favourite, and there were some stunning moves in this game, and which goals came from, but very near the end, it reminded me of the goal they got. Do you remember Trent Alexander-Arnold, the quickly taken corner?
Yeah.
He tried that again last night, but a ball quickly taken to the near post, which Sadio Mane only just missed with a diving header. But sharp thinking by the boy, the weak link.
Yeah, the weak link. The worst player. He's worse than Serge Aurier. That's his problem. It's been mentioned before, definitely worth watching the supercut of Erling Braut Haaland's 9 goals against the Honduran under-20s, if you haven't, mainly for the commentator. For the first couple of goals, he's pretty composed. He just gets ragged from goals 4 to 8, and by the 9th, he can just make individual sounds. Also in that group, Napoli were held to a goalless draw at Genk in a game they were heavy favourites to win. That helps Liverpool out a bit. Napoli top by just a point. Liverpool and Salzburg on 3, Genk with just 1. Liverpool host Leicester on Saturday at 3 p.m.
Yum.
Are you excited about that? I mean, you don't love the Premier League, Johnny. You've got to be a little bit excited about Liverpool, yeah. Leicester.
Oh, obviously. No, I mean, I really like football. I mean, you know, it's whatever my overriding other perceptions about the game are, the thought of Vardy running at anybody's slow centre halves, not that particularly slow, but anyway, but I just love seeing Vardy run. I always think Leicester fans get defensive about the fact that they're perceived to play a kind of old-fashioned version of the game where you just boot it long to the lad who can run fast. I think that's brilliant, yeah. By the way. It's just like, don't complicate the game with your double midfield pivots. Just boot it to the pigeon chaser.
Look at Max, he's lapping it up.
I totally agree. It's like the best goals are the ones where Tony Yeboah hits it really hard. with nothing. I like a chip, but really, I just want someone to larrup it. Yeah. In Liverpool's next 10 games, they've got Genk home and away, Napoli at home, Manchester United away, Spurs and Man City at home. So huge tests and Spurs to come over the next 2 months.
And Man United,
you're right. So really, really easy set of games for Liverpool. Right, that'll do for part one. We'll begin part two with Chelsea's victory in Lille.
The way things are isn't the way they have to be.
But knowing what to challenge and how to change it isn't always clear.
That's why independent journalism has never mattered more.
When we are free to follow any lead
and question any authority,
we can confront the status quo,
uncover vital alternatives,
and bring clarity to the world's most complex issues.
We can help our readers understand the world.
So together we can fight for a better one. Hope is power.
And with your support,
you'll always find it
at The Guardian.
Welcome to part two of The Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Got some live shows to tell you about. Barry, October the 30th at the Science Museum. Football Weekly versus Science. Me, you, Barney. Nicky Bandini as well. Plus some sciencey guests. We've almost sold out that one, Barry.
Okay.
Tickets only available in the science end. Do not wear your Football Weekly colours. November the 27th, we have not almost sold this out yet. Indigo at the O2. Me, you, Jonathan Wilson, Ellis James. We're playing the O2. We haven't divvied up the instruments yet, have we? We'd put Wilson on drums, I imagine. Don't you think? You on bass?
Why do I have to be on bass?
Because you've got a...
You've got a bass player's physique, Barry. Let's face it.
There you are. You,
what the hell does that mean?
It means if you're in the Who, you'd be called the Ox.
But it's the person who's no talent, can't play any instruments, who gets to play a bass. No,
do you mind? That's the instrument I started on.
Exactly, yeah.
My goodness. Brian Wilson, bass player. Paul McCartney, bass player.
Jaco Pastorius.
James Jameson.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah, Adam Clayton.
Yeah, well, obviously. Yeah.
John Taylor.
What does the Edge play? Is he on bass, isn't he?
No. Adam Clayton's.
He's on the Echo Chamber. Clayton.
There you go. Barry on bass. The other ones we'll sort out nearer the time. November the 27th, come to that, please, the Christmas special. December the 20th, we're playing the Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds. Me, Lars, and two others. January the 27th, Liberty Hall, Dublin. Me, Barry... plus two. Just a few tickets left for that. Ah, thank you, Ireland. If we sell out, we'll do another. We'll have a residency there again. Right. Lille 1, Chelsea 2. Important win for Chelsea this, Philippe. And look, they dug it out, didn't they?
Yeah, and actually, a very good game, I thought. Between two teams, which in many ways are similar. Take risks. Have taken the first risk is to gamble on youth and have been rewarded for that. A Lille team, which unfortunately is nowhere as strong as it was last season because they had to basically sell everybody. They had a huge debt, I mean, 162 million or something like that. But they have this capacity, thanks to very good recruiting, good scouting, and a bloody good manager, by the way, to put together a very competitive team. But again, Lampard, I think, proving quite a few people wrong in adapting to his role in finding and showing yet again what is becoming his trademark is his flexibility. It's Chelsea's unpredictable in the best possible sense of the word. I don't think the opposition has any idea of how he's going to set up. He's quite willing to take risks in the way he sets his teams up and his team selection and so forth, and they were rewarded, and good luck to them.
So what did he do that was surprising this time?
I mean, for example, one of the things he did is that nobody thought that he would team Rhys James and Azpilicueta in the same team. You would think, well, Rhys James could come in for Azpilicueta, but then he chooses a formation in which Rhys James is used as a wing-back, and it worked perfectly.
Tammy Abraham, Barry, is getting a lot of praise, and by all accounts will be in the England squad, the next one. Do we think this is the right thing to do?
I think he deserves a call-up. Am I correct in thinking he has other options open to him?
Nigeria.
Yeah, so I don't...
He does, but the from what I was listening to last night, the Nigerians think that he is going to play for England.
Okay, well, if he wants to play for England, he certainly deserves a call-up on the evidence of what we've seen so far this season. It's obviously a good time for him to get a call-up because England will qualify for the Euros, you know, pulling a cart. So it's a good time for Gareth Southgate to look at potential new recruits.
As a footballing purist, Johnny, how do you view that Willian volley? I, for one, when it's on the bounce, it just doesn't really count for me. I mean, it's still a volley, but it's just not beautiful unless it flies in.
The whole... lexicon of expressions to describe how and when a ball is hit is something as a personal vexation of mine. You know, the half volley is the quintessential volley the quintessential element of the volley family. So you strike it just as it hits the ground, as opposed to just lashing it in the air. That's more crude. The half volley is the sophisticated person's strike, I always feel. But again, these are notions I've developed based on absolutely nothing other than extreme bigotry and lunacy.
Chelsea go to Southampton on Sunday. Also in that group, Ajax won 3-0 at Valencia. Matthias says, will Ajax be the new Ajax in the Champions League? Absolute banger from Hakim Ziyech to put them one up. Dani Parejo struck the ball even cleaner for his penalty for Valencia, but he really missed that. I think it was, I don't know if you've seen it, it's like three goals higher. It was amazing. Quincy Promise and Donny van der Beek scored the other two. A good play from Dusan Tadic for the third as well.
Yes, magnificent. And interestingly, we were all wondering what this Ajax team were going to do once De Ligt and De Jong were gone. And the answer is that they're doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah,
which is brilliant.
Mm. When I watched part of the Ajax game, what really came to mind was how they sort of fizz and are effervescent like they were last season, just the same, despite the fact they've had so many players leave. And they just have a quality that I don't see in any other European side. Okay, they might not win anything, but they have a joy for football, which is really uplifting.
I only saw very limited highlights, but Dusan Tadic looked incredibly good. That's so good.
To the Etihad, Manchester City 2, Dinamo Zagreb 0. All the chat in this game, Philippe. I mean, City had buckets of chances, didn't they,
before
Sterling. David Silva had the biggest one, probably. Then Sterling scored, and Phil Foden came off the bench in the 91st and scored in the 95th. Really tapped the badge, didn't he?
Yeah.
To say he loves playing.
He loves playing for Manchester City.
And all the chat is about Phil Foden. Pep says, look, what should I say? I'm sorry for him. He deserves to play more. But Pep is also right in saying he's got quite a good selection of midfielders.
Yes, and I wanted to check actually how many minutes he'd played this season compared to last season. And I'm wondering if he hasn't played even less this season than...
Feels like less at this stage.
Absolutely.
He played a lot towards the end of the season, didn't he?
I mean, and there's a moment with the question, I mean, okay, he's still very young and so forth, but he's at an absolutely crucial time of his career, which is between 18 and 21. You've got to get game time. You've got to play regularly. He's not doing it. That's not good. So there comes a moment when he will have to think about it. It's very comfortable place he's in at Manchester City. Everybody loves him. Everybody speaks very highly of him. He earns a lot of money. But there must become a moment when you think, well, do I want to be a footballer or do I want to be a substitute for the rest of... Because when do you see him come into the team? When David Silva retires? Mm-hmm. At the same time, you've got Riyad Mahrez, who's really taken on. You've got Bernardo Silva, regardless of his know, problems. That might give him a chance, actually, for them to feature in a few games in the not-too-distant future.
But what would you do if you were... Would you go? I mean, it's so difficult to say, what do? You say in January, what, I want a loan somewhere, or I want to go somewhere else?
He would have his pick as well, wouldn't he? I mean, really, yeah. You know, there would not be a team in Europe that wouldn't take him, virtually. I think he would ask for a loan. In fact, I would just go, get out of the city. It's depressing. He's depressed me. And I would just think Sancho is the obvious illustration of how great your career, how quickly your career can develop as soon as you leave the cloying financial environment of City.
Now, Bernardo Silva has been charged, as you alluded to there, Philippe, with misconduct by the Football Association over that tweet he sent to Benjamin Mendy when he compared Mendy to the character on a packet of Conguitos. He's alleged to have committed, quote, an aggravated breach of FA rules, as it included reference, quote, expressed or implied to race and or colour and or ethnic origin. He has until the 9th of October to respond. City host Wolves on Sunday. Also in that group, Atalanta 1, Shakhtar 2. So Shakhtar on 3 points, Dinamo Zagreb, Atalanta bottom on 0. Real Madrid 2, Club Bruges 2. Ridiculously open game. And Bruges were 2 up with 2 quite hilarious goals. Emmanuel Denis tackled the first one in and fell over as he scored the second. But it was still a nice finish. Ramos scored a header which looked pretty offside from the original angle.
Yeah.
From a VAR found an angle where it wasn't offside.
It looked so offside. I don't
know. That was a terrific game.
It was a brilliant game, wasn't it? And
Club Bruges are, by the way, really great fun to watch week in, week out.
Is that right?
They're really, really good fun to watch.
How much time do you have on your hands to fight to watch Club Bruges?
No, it so happens I was in Belgium last weekend, actually. And I watched quite a bit of Club Bruges with a friend of mine who was showing me this is the way they play. Real Madrid should be worried. And he was absolutely right.
Simon Mignolet as well in goal for Bruges, in case that's the transfer that you'd completely missed. Galatasaray lost 1-0 to PSG. Icardi's first for PSG.
Yeah, and Sarabia is first assist, I think, in the Champions League as well. And I think it's 1-0, 1-0, 1-0 and 1-0 for PSG, which actually should worry people a little bit, because that was their problem was basically to be sometimes very open at the back and in midfield. They did the job and did it very seriously.
Is George Graham a part of the technical team now?
I will put the question to Thomas Tuchel.
I do. Barcelona beat Inter 2-1. They were 1-0 down very early on. Ter Stegen made a brilliant save as well from Lautaro Martinez, who put Inter ahead. Then Luis Suarez scored 2 absolutely beautiful goals.
Apparently it's finished. No, but that's what I've heard about Luis Suarez. Apparently he's finished.
The first was an absolutely wonderful volley from the edge of the box. Yeah. And the second, his first touch took it away from... It's almost impossible to take a touch that would give you the chance to score. I don't know which of those goals is better.
Do we have to judge?
Yeah.
No, we don't.
We can love them both. I think the second one, it was really gasping thing. My goodness, how do you do that?
And Alexis Sanchez was booked despite not being on the pitch. It's good to be involved, I guess, isn't it?
He's really having an interesting week, isn't he, Alexis Sanchez?
£39 a minute he earns, by the way.
Say again?
£39 a minute.
£39 a minute.
Yeah.
Sort of feels like a roaming charge, doesn't it? He did start the game, Alexis Sanchez, to be fair to him. One for Philippe from Francis. Mm. How will Messi and Griezmann work in the same team?
A very good question to which nobody has really an answer. There are loads of noise coming from Barcelona saying that they don't see eye to eye, that they it's not the question of just the way they play, but also their personal relationship is not that great. And there are elements within the Barcelona support who are I think, unfair with Griezmann. And it's not a happy family at the moment.
Slavia Prague 0, Borussia Dortmund 2. Both goals from Ashraf Hakimi in the second season of a 2-season-long loan from Real Madrid. The first was a brilliant run from his own half, wasn't it? A brilliant run from his own half as well. Group G, Zenit beat Benfica 3-1. Zuba, who appears to have grown a foot since I last saw him. He's a large man, isn't he?
What, an additional foot on the end of...
Three-footed.
Another leg?
No, I mean, he's just... Yeah. I don't see him often, right? I, unlike Philippe and his Club Bruges addiction. I don't have a Zenit addiction, so I haven't seen him for a while, and I'd just forgotten how large he was, but he appears to be bigger, or just hanging around with smaller people.
Seeing him closer up, perhaps. Yes,
it's also a possibility, isn't it? Have a look out for the Benfica goal as well. Raul de Tomás with an absolute, just a great hit. Just hit the ball really hard. Lyon won 2-0 at RB Leipzig.
Yeah.
Philippe.
So, to everybody's surprise.
First win in any competition since the 16th of August.
Yeah. When they started the season, they won 6-0, 4-0. And then since then, the wheels have gone off. And the new Brazilian revolution of Juninho Pernambucano and Silvinho hasn't quite worked. Actually, quite the opposite. But that's Lyon. You never know what to expect from them. And I thought, personally, that Leipzig, after, you know, being battered at the weekend, would react. And, in fact, they didn't. And Lyon took advantage, which to anybody who has watched Lyon in Ligue 1 over the past few weeks comes as a huge surprise.
Memphis Depay capitalised on some playing out from the back, which we all love so much. I mean, there are so many goals in these two games, and some from the Premier League as well, where just defenders just refuse to boot it these days, Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who refers to it as an obsession with playing PC football, which is essentially means that if you kick it more than about 20 metres, then somehow you're a football Neanderthal. So you have to pass it, even in extremis, and even though you can't pass it, and you're rubbish at passing, still got to try and pass it. Instead of just hoofing it away, get some bloody snow on it.
RB Leipzig, it was a shock defeat from them. They lost 3-1 to Schalke at the weekend as well, which was another surprise. You wanted to talk about Nagelsmann's coat.
Well, no, it wasn't his entire outfit. What it put me in mind of, right, is when I was a student in Newcastle. I used to live on a desperate area of Newcastle called Walker Road, and it used to have a Salvation Army hostel, and it's called the Mentz Palace, a place where the kind of bereft and homeless went. And they used to give them clothes, which were being donated. And Nagelsmann reminded me of a guy from the Men's Palace who'd picked up a lot of clothes that sort of fit but didn't really fit, that didn't match, or were completely random, but which kind of just about touched where he fitted. So he just kind of had this kind of park bench wardrobe look about him, which I rather admire.
How much time do you spend when you're watching a game watching football, and how much time watching what managers are wearing? Because I get slightly obsessed with hair.
Hair's gross. Yeah,
I really get hair, but for you it's what managers are wearing.
Well, basically football largely bores me, so I had to find some interest somewhere else.
Right, Group D, Juve beat Bayer Leverkusen 3-0, and Atletico won 2-0 at Lokomotiv Moscow. Europa League, Manchester United are AZ Alkmaar in what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer says is one of the worst AstroTurf pitches he has ever seen. Mm. It's not one of those sand-based ones where if you slide, you rip off the entire skin off your knee.
First of all, a pedantic point, it's AZ, not AZ Alkmaar, because the A stands for Alkmaar.
I stand corrected. Pogba's not playing because
he doesn't want to. Or something like that.
No. He's got an ankle injury, which an AstroTurf may make it.
A nagging injury. Yeah. One of those, yes. A nagging injury.
It's an ankle injury, which it might get worse on the terrible Astro. I'm looking forward. Hopefully it's one of those where the ball just bounces like 300 miles. Wolves are at Beşiktaş, Young Boys at Rangers. They all kick off probably before this pod is published. And this evening, Arsenal at home to Standard Liège, Celtic at home to Cluj. Arsenal's last game was that 1-1 draw at Old Trafford. I couldn't work out if this was a good or a terrible football match. Jonathan Wilson wrote in the paper yesterday, it felt and looked like a mid-table game between mid-table teams. Philippe, you have a vested interest in this.
Can I make a confession?
Of course.
I was at a gig on that night.
What gig was it?
My friend Stars playing at the Scala.
Oh, is that any good?
They're fantastic. I love them.
Marvellous. Barry, presuming you weren't at that gig.
No.
did this feel like a mid-table clash to you?
Well, everyone seems to have likened it to the narrative going into the game was it's probably not going to be as good as Manchester United and Arsenal contests of 15, 20 years ago, and it wasn't. I found it quite tedious, as games go. I'm not sure if that's just because it wasn't a very good game of football, or it's slightly sad slash funny, depending on your point of view, to see these sort of recently former superpowers of English football struggling so badly to kind of find some sort of identity. I think a draw was the fair result. Not a huge amount of use to either of them. But yeah, it wasn't a particularly good game, was it?
Granit Xhaka got some criticism, Johnny, for ducking out of the way of Scott McTominay's shot. That is seen as sort of one of the unforgivable sins of a footballer, isn't it?
It is. It's like a crime against masculinity, isn't it? You know, somehow you're not prepared to take a ball full in the face and to destroy all of your facial features and disfigure you for life. I don't know. I mean, like, those balls don't hurt when they hit you anyway, do they, man? It's not like an old leather caser full of water when they hit you.
Theo Walcott got knocked out cold by one last weekend.
He's made of glass and biscuits, though, isn't he?
I mean, it did take a little deflection, did it, off Socrates, and if it hadn't, I think Xhaka may well have put his face full in the way.
I think the fact that seems to be the main talking point of the game tells us all we need to know.
Yeah,
and I didn't see the game, but I have to plug what David Squires did about Granit Xhaka, which I think was pure genius in The Guardian. If you haven't seen that strip...
Can you talk us through it, or is it just...
No. Just discover it and spend time on every single frame. It's a work of genius.
Nicholas,
how to be more boring than Manchester United than Arsenal. Talk us through a cartoon.
Hey, I'm here to ask the questions. Nicholas Pepe, what do you make of Pepe... Philippe played for 74 minutes.
He's still as good as he ever was. He's only just arrived, you know, like yesterday. So give him time. It took Dennis Bergkamp 7 months to get used to life in the... It was not the... It was the Premier League already. It took Thierry Henry quite a long time as well to find his footing. That's absolutely nothing to worry about.
I actually think that one of the reasons in football that we have these reactions, overreactions, if you like, is because the transfer fees paid are so high. In every other normal part of society, you buy something that's incredibly expensive, you expect it to work immediately. And it's only in football where this doesn't apply. And it's just another one of the dysfunctions of having ridiculous transfer fees. It's just people go, well, I've paid for top of the range and it just looks like a normal human.
I love the idea of just buying a really expensive telly, but just say it's just got bed in. Yeah,
just got to warm up for a bit.
I've only got channel 5 for the first 4 months, but really, I really believe I'll get all the other channels after a few months. Once it's gelled with the other appliances in the living room. Football League time. There was a full fixture list in the Championship this week. Swansea are top after they came from behind to win at Charlton. They jump above West Brom. Serge Gnabry-less West Brom, who lost 1-0 at Leeds the night before. Alexander Mitrovic, Tom Cairney scored 2 each as Fulham won 4-1 at Reading, who had Jonathan Swift sent off in the 20th minute. Cardiff beat QPR 3-0 to keep up a 7-match unbeaten run. Cardiff decided to appeal against FIFA's ruling that they must pay the first instalment of €6 million to Nantes. Instead, they're going to challenge it at the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Cardiff have argued they were not liable for any of the full £15 million fee because Salah was not officially their player when he died. The club have refused to make interim payments, claiming the deal was not legally binding. Tom Lawrence started for Derby and Mason Bennett came off the bench as Derby drew 2-2 at Barnsley. Lawrence has been called up to the Wales squad this morning, a decision which is not amazingly popular with some Wales fans.
Both were booed when their names were announced over the tannoy at that game, which was quite interesting.
Yeah. In the game between the two bottom sides, Huddersfield beat Stoke 1-0. Junior Bakuna coming off the bench to score the only goal of the game. Late on, Huddersfield's first win of the season, Danny Cowley's first win in charge. Stoke have 2 points from 10 games in huge trouble. When Stoke was sort of held up as the paradigm of how to survive in the Premier League and cut your cloth accordingly, so much has changed. Nathan Jones, really honest afterwards, basically saying sounding like he knows the end is coming. This, on a slightly different note, from Petron, saying it's not really a question, but I can't stop laughing at this picture that Stephen Chicken found at the Britannia Stadium, which is a framed picture of Rory Delap stepping up to take a long throw on the wall at the Britannia, one of their finest moments, which is tremendous, actually, isn't it? But it was a big part of It's a big part of how they had their success.
Talk us through the picture, Max.
Ah, well, that's thank you so much. I absolutely will. What you have is you have...
Don't.
Rory Delap, he's literally just at the start of his run-up. A camera is right behind him, one of those Sky cameras, so you could get the full image if you were watching the game on TV. His mouth is open. You can see the anticipation as he's about to hurl the ball towards Peter Crouch or Ricardo Fuller. I don't have the other side of the picture.
I remember a Stoke player being on the radio, and he said that, or an ex-Stoke player, he said they only ever scored four goals from a long throw-in, but everybody was so terrified that they'd be one of the ones that let a goal in and look so stupid that it caused panic every time.
Only four?
Only, that's what he said, yeah.
That can't be
it
true.
It can't be true, but that's what he said.
Well, anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin chatting about your book, Johnny.
Oh, lovely.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Johnny, you've written a book, Can We Have Our Football Back? Brackets, How and Why the Premier League is Ruining Football and What We Can Do About It. So before we look ahead to this weekend's Premier League fixtures, let's talk about it. How and why has the Premier League ruined football?
Money. It's money. I mean, there are lots and lots of issues, but all of them spring from grotesque amounts of money, grotesque transfer fees, grotesque agents' fees, obscene wages. All of these things take the people's game away from the people.
Now, generally on this podcast, if anyone criticises any aspect of football, they're accused of not liking the game by certain, not all fans, but a certain section of fans / listeners who seem not to care about any of that stuff. Why should they care?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to impose my moral values on absolutely everybody. All I can do is speak for how I see it and how a lot of people I know see it. And it's worth bearing in mind that I specifically talk about the Premier League here as opposed to any other form of football. And more people watch football that isn't the Premier League than watch the Premier League. So, you know, football does exist in a more pure, kind of civic, rootsy-based way in at other levels. But top flight football is an entirely different beast, driven on by paywall TV, rights fees, and driven on, I think, essentially by a kind of sleight of hand, an accident of history, which has led to enormous fees being paid to broadcast football to almost nobody. And I think there's a kind of deceit at the heart of it, really.
And was it better before?
No, you see, this is. I'm glad you said that, because a lot of criticism I get, as, shall we say, an older person, is that I want to go back to the past. And I know what was wrong with the past every bit as much as I know what's wrong with now. I have no interest in it returning to the 70s or 80s at all. What I want to do is create a top flight of football that is more fair, is more financially sane, is based around the fans who go rather than those who watch on TV, and basically to pay people well, but not insanely well, because I just think that I think the Premier League sets a standard for materialistic consumption that is unsustainable for the planet. And I think we have to really, really genuinely, and I know people think this is pretentious and silly, but if we don't address the fact that making people inordinately wealthy, the only point in doing that is so they can buy more stuff. And buying more stuff kills the planet. We've got to stop buying stuff and live more frugally. So while docking some wages in the Premier League won't do much for the carbon in the atmosphere, it will symbolically change a lot in that.
So how would you possibly do that?
How would you do what? Change the wages?
Yeah.
Right, okay, this is how you do it. And this is what the book is. It's a blueprint for how to revolutionise football and society. What you do is you stop playing for paywall telly straight away. That won't actually make a lot of financial difference to the broadcasters because they're already losing money. But it would change everything. Because it says, essentially what it does is it says we won't put up with this anymore. This is not how we want football to be. Secondly, we lobby government to have all live football made a listed sport and for all the rights to broadcast it to be purchased by the state. And in doing that, we return it to a mass audience and we allow everybody to see it and be part of it rather than be isolated in our own little financial cliques. And the book is an explanation in detail of why what effect this would have on society, how it would change society.
Would it be fair to describe it then, what you're saying, perhaps not as a blueprint, but rather as a utopia in the proper sense of the word, which is you use a model which you think is the correct model,
yeah,
and then you compare it with what's happening to show what is wrong with what is actually happening. Is that a fair way to say it? Because the argument would be the Premier League just happens to be a global championship, which is played in England, but it is global, and you cannot exist outside of the globality of it, because the money, it's also La Liga, it's also Juventus, it's also Bayern, it's also PSG, it's also the Chinese Super League now. Mm. So how would it be possible to create, to have a kind of exceptionalism, as it were, for top-level football?
Well, I don't propose it would be an exceptionism. I propose it would be a waterfall of attitude that would spread right across Europe. And that, because the same discontent, as we've seen for expressions of fans in Italy and in Germany, exists all over, which is that it's been taken away from us. What was once ours has been sold by media companies and sold back to us, and that we're not happy about it. So I see it as partly, yes, utopia is a good idea, a good way to conceptualise it, and I'm not naive enough to think, A, I've got all the answers, or B, we just follow these steps and everything will be cool. But unless we have a standard that we want to aim for, unless we have principles and morals behind it, then we will just live in a state of perpetual capitalist anarchy. And I don't like that. I don't want that. I want football to be part of our civic and community lives. I don't want it isolated, depending on how much money you've got to spend on paywall TV or whatever.
But do you think that it's good to have a utopian idea, but actually what would be useful would be a realistic answer, because this isn't going to happen, right?
No, this will happen. I mean, whether or not it happens because of my book would be rather pompous to think. I mean, part of what I'm trying to do is put ideas out there for people to consider and to mull over, because a lot of these things are never said. We don't seem to have a common discourse about wages in football that is based on the fact that I think it's immoral. I think that level of wealth is immoral.
Would compare it to movie stars or boxers or Formula One races.
I think that level of wealth is immoral as well. But don't forget, that is those things. Like, if you are a rock star, you earn a ton of money because your records sell or your gigs sell. If you're a footballer, that doesn't apply. It's a wage. One is a market value. The other is just, we give you £39 a minute, Alexis. It doesn't matter whether you play or not, you get it anyway. It doesn't matter if you shit, you get it anyway. So it's different. But I'm against grotesque wealth. I just don't think it's right. And this doesn't seem to ever get said anymore. There was a time when it did. You know, 30 years ago, people would go, or 40 years ago, people would think transferring a player for £1 million was obscene. People thought that sponsorship on shirts was immoral and wrong and defiled the shirt. And these are things that are not in common currency anymore. But we have a new generation that lives and breathes and thinks differently to how people my generation and below me do.
You've spoken to a footballer for the book who openly admits that the amount of money he earns is completely ridiculous.
Yeah, I did. I spoke to a Premier League player who has been playing for over 12 years. And he gets £2.5 million a year. He said, I get £200,000 into my account. And he said, I've had everything I need for years and years and years. I don't need any more money. And he tells me, he drops handfuls of 20s into beggar's cups on the streets. He pays all his tax in the UK, doesn't make any tax avoidance schemes or anything like that. And he just said, he and many others he knows just feel like they're completely overpaid. They're embarrassed about it. And they would pay for minimum wage if minimum wage was all that was available. And he said to me, I'm a good footballer. I'm not massively special. If you paid me £100,000 a year to reflect that, I'd be in the top 5% earners in the country. Mm. That would properly reflect where I am. And he said, I've got everything I need. Don't need any.
But I mean, is he the exception to the rule? I mean, there are lots of footballers who say, I'm earning £150,000 a week and it's not enough.
Yeah.
I mean, he sounds like a wonderful, you know, beautiful individual, but...
He said that, yes, there are really greedy bastards. He did say, and he gave me a list of the greediest bastards he knew who are obsessed with it. But he said, most aren't like that. Most are just working class kids who've grown up on an estate and take the money because it's there. But if it wasn't there, they wouldn't be any less happy for it. And I do a whole thing in the book about, we have clinical evidence now that wealth doesn't make people happy. That around about 55,000 quid a year is the level at which what they call emotional contentment is established at. And beyond that, you gain no further happiness. So the acquisition of endless wealth isn't in pursuit of anything that's worth having. And that, you know, money is a dead end in that regard. Being able to buy more things is not an achievement.
Can you envisage a time when a big club, you know, an owner of a big club says, I've had it, and leaves it to fall into disrepair?
I don't know. I mean, I suspect large clubs have so many assets, somebody will always come and buy them. But the insanity of the finances of the Premier League washed down the divisions because people want, falsely in my view, to get to the kind of rich upland pastures of finances. So they bet the farm, like Bolton and Bury, on getting promoted and then fail. But even further down the league, I mean, I looked at Scunthorpe, who are currently second bottom of the fourth tier. Their turnover in 2018 was 4.4 million, which is quite good for a small business. They lost 4 million quid because they paid the players 3 million pounds. A 30-man squad was on an average of £100,000 a year in the fourth tier, which means some of them would have been on 150, some on 30. That's insane. It doesn't make any sense. It's way too much money. But it's because football is seen in this way. And it's seen as a, you know, you've got to keep paying more and more, but what do you pay for? What do we all get out of that? I don't think we can anything.
Did you speak to the Premier League directly?
I didn't directly. I did send them an email about some of their figures, but no, they're not keen on talking, really.
The book is called Can We Have Our Football Back? Who's it published by?
By Head Publishing, which happens to be my publisher.
Oh, that's useful. Double bubble. Are you sharing the profits among all authors?
Yeah, no, I'm nothing if not a hypocrite.
The Premier League have got a new CEO, Nick from The Guardian. What were we thinking? Why did we not batten him down? David Pemsel. It was confirmed on Wednesday morning.
I thought it was Barry.
It's apparently not Barry. Bruce Buck, who was the chairman of Chelsea, tasked with recruiting the individual to administer the top tier of English football, said he's been hired because of, quote, his straightforward style and personal integrity. At The Guardian, he's shown strong leadership through a period of change and transformation. Returning the group to profit is an impressive achievement. I think that's mainly down to Football Weekly that The Guardian is
turning a profit. Well, I would like to think we are largely responsible, yes, for returning the group to profit.
So Bruce
with our sold-out live shows.
Exactly.
And our podcast adverts.
Why did Bruce Buck not come calling for us is the extraordinary thing. He's been the chief executive of Guardian Media Group, the owner of The Guardian and The Observer since July 2015. Working with editor-in-chief Kath Viner, he helped to increase the company's digital revenues while cutting costs. Good luck at the Premier League. Right, Premier League then. Brighton Spurs is the early kickoff on Saturday. Will Spurs bounce back, Philippe?
I have no idea.
Excellent news. could do each game like this.
Yeah, and the response would probably pretty much say
that's why you get big money. I mean,
yeah,
it's true. Their heart. We don't know, do we?
No,
that's the joy of it, right? Burnley, Everton, Liverpool, Leicester is a standout game. Norwich, Villa, Watford, Sheffield United. Leo says, "Hi Max. Speaking of transfers that passed me by, Aurelio Gomez was 99% sure he would retire at the end of last season and was due to become a pastor before Watford convinced him to stay for another year. I certainly didn't know that.
What sort of pastor?" Tagliatelle?
Yeah, very good. West Ham Palace is the late kickoff. Four games on Sunday. Arsenal, Bournemouth, Man City, Wolves, Southampton, Chelsea and Newcastle, Manchester United. Alistair says, looking ahead at Newcastle's fixtures, is it almost inevitable that they will get relegated unless there's some form of miracle? I looked at their fixtures. Their next few are Man United, Chelsea, Wolves, West Ham, Bournemouth. Perhaps he just means all the other Premier League teams. It may not be inevitable, Alistair. Have faith. England's women play Brazil in Middlesbrough. Johnny, are you excited?
Yeah, well, you know, such exoticism in the distant northeast. I think it's a great ground actually for a game like that, because it isn't very full very often, and in fact it's getting half full most of the time now. So it'll be nice to see the ground absolutely packed out. It's a good atmosphere when it is full.
Neil says, what does Johnny think of the Australian hijacking of the Middlesbrough Palmo and calling it a Palmy?
Well, you see, Palmo is almost, that's really already an Australian constriction, isn't it? They're putting O on the end of things. I'm not for Palmy at all.
No, I think it's a Palmer. The current Mrs. Rushton would call it a chicken Palmer.
Nah, it's Palmo.
Okay. Andrew says, what time do you all go to bed? Barry, what's your bedtime?
Varies.
An average.
It varies. I mean, sometimes I'm in bed by 9:30, sometimes I'm still up at 2 in the morning.
Versatile.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm at 9:45 at the latest, check the headlines on news at 10, and then go to bed.
Crikey.
Yeah. I'm a morning person.
I'm a midnight child.
Okay.
Yeah, me too, man. Yeah, midnight for me.
Tim says, as Max asked so nicely, I've listened to the second ever pod, released 2 weeks after the first. We won't do this every single pod. On the second pod was the 24th of May 2006, Barry. Jimbo in the chair with Sean Ingle, Barry and Gab Marcotti. An improvement in sound quality on pod one, as Barry seemed like he was talking into a smaller bucket. topics discussed in the second pod, Italy's World Cup prospects in light of Calciopoli, the dropping of the trouserless Goleo as World Cup mascot and World Cup tat, including PVC dresses with the cross of St. George on them, which Barry brought up in conversation at least twice in 2006. Also,
I'm surprised I got to speak twice if Marcotti was on.
There was also a recording of an interview with Erectile Dysfunction's Pele, a report on tournament preparations from Chris Alden in Nuremberg, and Barry responded to an email which suggested he was like a non-swearing Bob Geldof with a robust fuck off. Would you like what happened in pod three on Monday?
Not really.
Okay.
Although it is nice to hear what they were like when we were all sort of young and idealistic, less cynical.
Anyway, thank you very much, Tim. Your work is done. And thank you for today. Thanks, Philly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny.
Cheers, man.
Cheers, Baz.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.